I'm now very pleased to introduce our next speaker, Professor Kathleen Daly, who we've already heard from the floor. Professor Daly is a Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice from Griffith University in Brisbane. She writes on gender, race, crime and criminal justice, and on restorative, Indigenous and transitional justice. Her recent work is on conventional and innovative justice responses to violent victimisation in different contexts of violence and on redress, restoration and reparation. Her recent book, Redressing Institutional Abuse of Children, 2014, which we have here, analyses 19 major Australian and Canadian cases of historical institutional abuse. She is the editor or author of 6 books and over 90 journal articles or book chapters. Professor Daly is also a fellow of the Academy of Social Service Sciences in Australia and the American Society of Criminology, and was past president of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Criminology, and she comes to us very well presidential to speak on today's topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be here and to speak to this area. I've been working in the field of criminology, sexual victimization, legal responses for a very long time. All of the comments that have been made, I can give you data and stats on, but it is a very different situation for people with disabilities, as has been discussed. Unfortunately, as you'll see in my presentation, there's very little in the area of redress schemes and how redress schemes operate, which Jess asked me to speak on, that actually considers people with disabilities. So that will be one of the take-home messages. In any event, I'm going to explain to you what I've learned from my 19 cases of Australian and Canadian cases of abuse in residential and out-of-home care. And from that, I'm going to answer some questions that Jess asked me to address in terms of redress and its relationship to civil litigation. I want to give a little bit of background so we can see the broader picture of what's been happening in the last 20 years. In my book, I analyzed 19 cases, 11 in Canada and 8 in Australia, as of mid-year 2010. And by a case of institutional abuse, I mean a jurisdiction or institutional set of activities that brought institutional abuse to public attention, to which there was then sustained responses by government, church, and charitable organizations. Now, since 2010, there have been more cases in Canada and Australia, including, of course, the Royal Commission. In addition to the 19 cases in my study, I estimate today, my research team and I do, that there are at least 40 more going on in the rest of the world. These are pretty much affluent countries of the rest of the world. In fact, today, 20 countries or jurisdictions have initiated or concluded independent inquiries and or redress schemes for institutional abuse of children. All of these are located in Australia, New Zealand, North America, Europe, the UK, and Scandinavia. It's ironic because, of course, institutional abuse is growing by leaps and bounds of children in the developing world, so we're growing our next generation. But redress schemes are now happening in the affluent nations. Canada, Ireland, and Australia were the first countries to establish redress schemes. Canada in 1993, Ireland in 2002, and 6 months later, Australia in 2003 in Tasmania. Since then, redress schemes have been established in 7 other jurisdictions. Now, I give you all this data to just demonstrate that redress activity, by which I include both civil litigation and redress schemes, for institutional abuse is quite recent, but it's a huge and growing phenomenon. So just briefly, what do we mean by institutional abuse? This is actually quite a contested question. It much depends on how you define institutional and how you define abuse. I'll just turn to how the Royal Commission is defining it. Unusual compared to really any other place because, in the sense of inquiries or redress schemes, because it includes a broad range of institutional contexts, residential care, other types of out-of-home care. That typically is the focus of redress schemes. But in addition to this, the Royal Commission is including a wide range of community-based settings. Virtually any place that has adult contact with children, except in family settings. So it's huge in terms of the broad context of abuse. Where abuse occurs, but abuse itself is limited to sexual abuse alone, which is a real problem for those subject to historical abuse, I have to say, especially in residential settings. So when we ever get to see the proposed redress scheme somewhere in this building, I understand, we will see a quite complex set of questions an ability to try to address a complex set of questions about institutional abuse just because of that very broad set of institutional contexts. All right, that's a little bit of background. I want to turn to some of Jess's questions. She asks, what is redress? What does it actually mean, and what does it look like? Well, if you just go to a dictionary definition, redress means to set right, to remedy, to make up for, etc. If you translate that to institutional abuse, I would say, I make the following definition. Victim redress is all the activities, processes, and outcomes that recognize and provide a compensatory mechanism for harms or wrong against an individual or a group. Redress can take two forms in responding to institutional abuse: civil litigation, as Philip has told us about, and redress schemes. Now, in the literature, you see redress and reparation almost used interchangeably. Reparation is more likely to be used in the international context in transitional justice, but we see it creeping into certain schemes, as was mentioned from the floor, the reparation scheme in the DART response. But I'm calling it redress in this context. Of the 19 cases in my analysis, 14 had redress schemes, 2 had civil settlements only, and 3 had public inquiries only. Those 3 public inquiry only cases are the 3 major historical abuse cases in Australia: Forgotten Australians, Stolen Generations, and Child Migrants, all of which had no redress scheme, but had other types of services, and of course, big inquiries. Now, it's interesting to see developments that can occur between redress and civil litigation. I want to describe 2 cases to you where redress schemes were forged in the shadow of civil litigation. I would like to see more of this occur, if it can occur. But as Philip suggests, civil litigation is very hard to move on unless certain types of elements are present. I want to give you these what happened in these 2 cases. In the Indian Residential Schools case, a Canadian case, the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement was the largest out-of-court settlement in Canadian history. That settlement outlined a comprehensive redress package of monetary payments, benefits and services, commemorative activities, a truth commission, and a national research center. Now, that was just settled in 2006, and the redress scheme came into being in 2007. Well, why was that successful? Those lawyers had a whole string of criminal prosecutions to stand on. That's what made it possible for about 16,000 individual plaintiffs coming forward in collected or individual civil claims. The second case was the Jericho Hill School for the Deaf in Vancouver. There were 2 redress schemes in that case. One was a government-stipulated redress scheme. That's a typical approach, either government or church-stipulated. But the second was what I call a redress package, same as Indian residential schools, a negotiated outcome that came from a class-action settlement. So class-action settlements don't just have to be money payouts. They can include a broader array of elements, and these often are what survivors are seeking, not just a monetary payment. For now, I would just say that we can differentiate between redress schemes and redress packages. The schemes typically have a monetary payment, counseling, and apologies. Some have educational and medical or health benefits. What the Royal Commission is proposing is smack dab into what is standard. This is the world standard now in terms of typicality. I'm not saying it's the best, but monetary payments, counseling, and apologies. Those are the three elements. The packages have more elements. Commemorative activities, trust funds, scholarships are the sorts of examples I've just given you. Looking outside of Australia and Canada, most schemes are similar in having this troika of monetary payments, counselling and apologies. But one that's somewhat unusual is the Magdalene Redress Scheme. It's a scheme for women in Ireland. It's unusual in that not only is there a monetary payment, but it's also based on lost wages in terms of money paid out, along with a pension top-up and provision for health and medical services. So it took more of a social welfare response. How do redress schemes include or expand beyond civil litigation is a question that Jess asked. Well, let's look at why redress schemes were established. There were two broad reasons. One, from a plaintiff's perspective, it's very difficult to prove a case, as we've just heard. Evidence is, can't be sought. And even if you're within the statute of limitations, it's hard to get, but typically there are time limits, and if you're in a place where you don't have to worry about those time limits, it's very even more difficult to get that evidence. So from the plaintiff's perspective, they're a good idea. From the defendant's perspective, they may also be a good idea because they may contain costs and time spent in litigation. Now, the outcomes from civil litigation are typically just money, whereas redress schemes have both money and other types of elements. If I look to see what is happening with redress schemes, they're designed to handle a large number of cases, like a batch approach, in the same way that a class action is a batch approach to civil litigation, with the aim of expediting decision-making processes, applying similar benefits and services, or providing similar benefits and services to those eligible, devising an assessment process that's similar and equitable across a wide population of claimants, that's very important to survivors, and reducing the need for significant lawyer time. Lawyer costs in those cases that have large redress schemes, like the Irish case, or in Indian residential schools, will be anywhere from 15% to 30% of the overall payout. Just so you know, lawyers' fees are not insubstantial. What I find interesting about redress schemes is they actually, even, we got the information from Philip about, if you're a plaintiff in a civil suit, you need to testify and do this and that. That's so unusual. How unusual is it that these cases ever get to trial? The more likely situation that happens in civil litigation is the lawyers are talking to each other. You talk to your client, as a lawyer in a civil case, but for the most part, interactions are between lawyers in and outside the courtroom. For redress schemes, the survivors have to do more work. They have to get information, they have to fill out forms, they have to interact with people and so forth. So it's more of an active participation on the part of survivors. And ideally, there can be more involvement by survivor groups in the design and implementation of redress schemes. And there has been as well. Not many, but in some. This is much less likely in civil litigation. So what got me into doing this research in the first place is I was interested to see what types of innovative responses were survivor groups coming up with, because that to me was an interesting point, an opening point, and a different point for redress schemes as compared to civil litigation. Well, why is redress important compared to other responses? The two responses, civil litigation and redress, we've discussed. The two others are criminal prosecution and public inquiries. Criminal prosecution can be vindicating to victims if you get a plea or a conviction at trial. However, criminal prosecution is not a compensatory mechanism unless there's a sentence order, which doesn't happen very often for restitution or compensation. Public inquiries, and there are also associated other types of activities such as listening forums, are a truth-seeking mechanism. They intend to bring out the truth of institutional practices and what's happened in terms of authorities' responses. These are actually quite important to survivors in terms of putting a record of what occurred into the public arena and documented and preserved in some place. So quite important. I would say, though, that of equal importance and what I see to be happening as much, if not more often, is that victim voice and experiences are registered in other ways, in books by journalists, biographies and autobiographies by survivors, in film, television, and DVDs, or as part of oral history projects, museum installations and plays. There's a very important other media involvement here, which goes beyond what public inquiries or listening forums can accomplish. One of the questions that we need to consider is, why do redress schemes vary in the particular design and implementation that they take? Unfortunately, here we don't have any evidence. Well, one or two of my cases gave me some insight on this, but very few cases have this. We would like to know how and why redress schemes are designed the way they are. I mean, who decided what elements to include? Who decided what the monetary payments should be? Who decided what the process of implementation should look like? That's really important. Redress schemes just don't kind of land on the table. They take a long time to figure out. And then once they do happen, what are the lessons learned? Well, of the 19 cases, there were 14 with redress schemes. And of those 14, just two had reports on how those decisions were made, the processes of implementation, and lessons learned. So that tells us that the wisdom that could have been learned has been lost, and that's unfortunate. I want to talk about one of the two reports that was made, and this was for the Jericho Hill case, but it was for the government-stipulated scheme. This is Jericho Hill School for Deaf Students. The report is actually quite good in showing how procedures were developed that were appropriate for students in applying to that redress scheme. It's one of three cases that solely involved people with disabilities in my group of 19, and there were, in addition, four other cases of those with physical or mental disabilities that were named as being among those in the institutions. However, except for Jericho Hill, there is no information in any of the other schemes on whether procedures were adapted to address the needs of these particular groups. So we don't know, on the basis of redress schemes, what people have tried and what things they need to be thinking about, although a lot of the ideas that have come up here would be obviously quite relevant in terms of both court proceedings as well as civil proceedings. In general, what I would say, even though there's not a lot of evidence, reading between the lines, that redress schemes can be explained by precedent. That is, what did someone do last year? What has happened over here? And so forth. What is familiar to scheme designers? And I must say, what's familiar is not very innovative. It's very legalistic. It's not thinking outside the box. It's really quite contained. I would like to see more innovation. And finally, of course, cost containment. Now, cost containment is not something that I think is a bad thing. We can't spend billions and billions and billions. We have to think about how to use money wisely. And that, in the case of the Australian scheme, will involve 45% at least of taxpayer money. Finally, the question, what are the experiences of seeking redress from the perspective of victims? This is what we really want to know. Well, guess what? No research in Australia on this question. No study has been carried out of victims' experiences in previous redress schemes in Queensland, Tasmania, South Australia, or Western Australia, nor of those in church-based schemes. But we do have a few case studies that have come out of the Royal Commission, but a few case studies here and there do not add up to the wide range of experiences. And we also, of course, see news stories, but we need a broader set of understandings of what occurred. There is more research available from Canada. Based on that, as well as some of the more anecdotal research from Australia, there are four important areas to consider in the design and thinking about redress schemes from a survivor's perspective. The first is there any survivor group participation in redress scheme design? This is, I think, an important thing. It doesn't necessarily lead to people being happy with what came out of it, but to the extent that you have involvement and you can actually say, this is what you should be thinking about, that's the first question. Once the scheme is established, the next question is, how well do survivors know about it? Do they know how it works? Do they know where to get information about it? Do they have sufficient information and support in deciding whether to participate or not? This is a big problem in redress schemes. Many survivors don't get the information, they don't know how it works, etc. Next, then, is the process of filling out an application form. Can you fill out the application form? Is it easy to understand? Some of these forms are really quite complicated, too complicated, really. Are they victim-friendly? How much support and assistance is there in completing the forms and going through the process? Now, there have been a number of survivor groups in Australia who have been active in supporting victims in this process. And then finally, do the outcomes of these schemes match victims' expectations? Why and why not? Typically, there'll be some grumpy ones and some not so grumpy and pleased people. One of the things that I see, however, is that accurate information on what exactly the outcomes are is not forthcoming. So there can be a bit of kind of chit-chat among survivor groups that this happened or that happened. It's not really true. That's a problem, but it gets back to the problem that there are no good reports written on what happened as a result of these redress schemes. So in general, looking at the experiences, I'd say there's a great deal of variation in survivor experiences. The processes of applying are important, not just the outcomes of the scheme. That is, the how is just as important as the what. That is so crucial. How people are treated, are they treated with dignity and respect, do they know what's going on, etc. In terms of the monetary payments, highly mixed, where we have data, where we see both positive and negative responses or qualified positive responses. To start off, most survivors say it's not the money that matters, rather the motives are to be heard and believed, that is validation, or for the abuse to be recognized and acknowledged, that is vindication, counseling, medical, dental, vocational and educational benefits can matter more to some than a lump sum payment. I would add to this that there are other aspects of redress that are important. Public apologies, if they are sincere, and often they are not, they need to be done in a really strong and careful way. Memorials, commemoration, other memory projects, all of these are significant activities, not only for victim survivors, but also for members of the general public who have little understanding of the histories and practices associated with institutional abuse. And we talk about the police a lot, but police are just one segment of the entire population that probably needs to be significantly re-educated in a variety of ways about institutional abuse, and I would say also specific to this forum, to those with disabilities going through the process of seeking redress for institutional abuse. So that's redress in a nutshell, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. And I think I was actually meant to preface this section by mentioning that redress is currently a proposal that's very much in the mix. For the Royal Commission, there's been a number of issues papers actually released, and the Royal Commission spent some time looking at the potential for redress. And I believe there's a report currently with the Governor-General as part of the Royal Commission's work. Do we have questions?
I hope it's with the Attorney General by now.
I asked that question this morning.
Do you know where it is? I thought it might be in this building. We haven't seen it yet. Wendy. I think Wendy had her hand up.
Thanks. the Victorian government at the moment's got a discussion paper about a redress scheme in this context, mm-hmm. and one of the things they're talking about a lot is the evidentiary issues, I suppose, and you touched on it earlier, the issue around balance of probabilities and plausibility. Do you have any
This is important from the perspective of the trade-offs in redress. If you want a high money payment, you're going to have to go through higher hurdles. All of the redress schemes that have the highest monetary payments, the Irish and the Indian Residential School Level 2 payment, have a pretty strong, and their averages are about $80,000 to $100,000 in terms of the monetary payout. They require a very strong evidentiary, at least assembly of documents and documentation. If you can assemble those documents, you have the support to assemble those documents, the trade-off will be, and you have the time to go through that process, you will get a higher money payment, and it comes out in your favor. And the assessment in terms of claimant likelihood of getting a yes is about 75% in those two cases. Those are unusual cases. Those are the two highest cases in terms of payout in all the redress schemes currently in the world today. More likely, the payout is going to be anywhere from $20,000 to $50,000, a lower threshold of evidentiary evidence standard is required there, from plausibility to likelihood, but not the preponderance of the evidence. So it really has to do with the trade-offs. One of the things that survivors need to know is that you're not going to get very much money with a plausibility standard in a redress scheme. But ultimately, it has to do with how much the whole scheme will cost. With Australia now, with the estimate of 65,000 survivors, it's one of the highest in the world. The Indian Residential School case had 100,000 claimants, but most of those did not go to that high level 2 approach. Most did not. They went to the level 1 payment, and their average payment was 20,000, and that was based on years spent in a residential school. So it really has to do with how much evidence do you have and how much time do you have to push your claim, even in a redress scheme.
Can I just throw something in there? Philip talked earlier about the sort of conditioning of some people with disabilities, including people with intellectual disabilities, but I'd argue not limited to those, have to say yes to things that are put in front of them. How important is ward advocacy being walking with somebody through a redress scheme?
It's absolutely crucial. I mean, even if you've been through university reading these documents, of these application forms, it's not straightforward. The other aspect is just decoding some of the questions. Just for standard, people without disabilities, it's not straightforward. So I wish I knew the answer to your question completely. As I said, there's only one report that talks about this in any at all. And that's from the perspective of the decision makers, not from the application process side of it. But the application side of it for, and in this case for the School of the Deaf, they really needed people with sign ability, etc., just to get the information. So it's not just the advocacy, it's the support in getting the information in a format that's in the abled world, but not necessarily in the communicative style that might be in another set of capacities. So it's crucial, and I haven't seen it discussed in any redress scheme. So I'm not even sure if it was in the consultation paper. I didn't read all of the Royal Commission's consultation paper on this. So does anyone recall that? Those of you from the Royal Commission. The processes of actually going through it are as important as all the particular elements. It's so crucial, and we need to get that right. So, yes, I'd say unreservedly, yeah, important.
Craig kind of just asked the question, actually, that I was going to ask, which was about advocacy support, but I'll just follow up with something. Because I was, before I came to Canberra last year, I was managing an advocacy So we did indeed have clients who received compensation, and I have some sense of the amount of advocacy support, the length of time that it took, the amount of work that's involved is really, over a long period of time, is pretty intense, and how to fund that is a huge issue when there's enormous demand on disability advocacy and it's under-resourced.
But see, part of it, to me, that's part of justice. It's the part of access to justice. And if those processes are done right and respectfully, I think that's part of a positive type of response. And that's why I think we really need to look very, very seriously at putting money into process, because it matters ultimately, all along the way. Now, are you talking about the Tasmanian scheme? Yes, right. And you're talking about phase 1, 2, and 3, because phase 4 had no, was much, much more of a shoehorned approach. I think Tasmania, I think of all the jurisdictions, was the most thoughtful, as I look back at the redress schemes that have been done. Western Australia had a lot of support through the local advocacy group, that I'm not quite sure how they were funded, but there were advocacy groups in Perth that were supporting a lot of the survivors' applications, Cybers and the other major one that's there. There are several actually in Perth. Queensland was not good from what I can determine. And let's see, Queensland, Tasmania, WA, I'm missing one. South Australia, zero, from what I can determine. South Australia went through the Victims of Crime Fund, and as far as I can understand, I don't know what kind of support was supplied at all in that scheme.
Do we have other questions? What about perpetrators?
Oh, yeah. No one's talking about perpetrators. You just raised the question. Are you talking about perpetrators with disabilities?
No, how does redress... One formulation of redress, you have to think like, say, an insurance system, or like some of the criticisms that we heard about beyond healing, is that it becomes an institutionalised process within a place to deal with these complaints in a kind of systemised way, rather than dealing with them through the criminal justice system that holds people to account. What is the role of dealing with perpetrators within redress?
Redress schemes do not deal with that. There would be another process that would be involved. It should be actually quite separate, I think. Except that if you were to report, now this happened in Tasmania as well, if you reported something, it would be moved over. My Tasmanian colleague will fill us in on this. It would be brought over to the police, you know, and you would bring it over in the same way that occurs within public inquiries. But then the question, what you're asking for is, you know, what you're asking about is, well, once we identify someone who has alleged to have done these things, what is the process then that can be set in motion? Well, at that point, it's criminal prosecution. I would love to imagine there could be another kind of accountability mechanism. In fact, I think that would be great. But because criminal prosecution is going to be very hard to achieve, certainly not of a, you wouldn't be able to do it of an organization, but even of an individual, it's going to be hard to achieve. So I would love to imagine that there could be new forms of accountability that we could devise that would be short of criminal prosecution, that would provide some measure of validation and vindication. What those are, I don't know, but I think we should start thinking about what they could be.
Because there's organisational accountability as well as individual.
Well, there's organisation, but accountability, the term accountability is used to refer to so many different things, doesn't it? So if you're talking about a legal accountability, that's one kind of thing. You could talk about moral accountability, which is also what they talk about. And perhaps there is some way to some kind of quasi-legal forum that could actually handle those questions of moral accountability in a way that seems as good as we can get within the very restricted limits of what criminal liability can do. Very hard to get a criminal prosecution and conviction, although not impossible, not impossible. If we wanted to, and there are quite a few cases going forward from the Royal Commission. So we'll see what happens in terms of how those cases are handled, and elsewhere, not just the Royal Commission. But I would like to see an approach that isn't always reliant on criminal law. I think we give too much attention to criminal law as a source of thinking that we're doing the right thing, because there could be other more satisfying mechanisms that would get us what we want.
I think that's a good note to end on, and this is also a topic that we could devote an entire other seminar to. So,
yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Craig.